welcome to The Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week we are going to France and looking at one of the leaders of the French New Wave, Jean-Luc Godard, and his 1960 classic, Breathless. This film is considered a prime example of the French New Wave. Returning back on the show today is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure having you. So, you know, when I think of this film, this is my second time watching this. When I think of the French New Wave, this is always a film that pops into my head. I think, like, if you had to study one film to learn what that movement was all about, I would say it's watch this film to get a great understanding of it.
I wish I could stream this film for my class because it is a perfect example of the French New Wave. It has so many interesting jump cuts, which were actually an accident. Mm-hmm. But it's a great example of the French New Wave, and it has so many French New Wave people involved in the film, either as extras or writers. It's just a great who's who of the movement.
I even think Godard himself appeared in the film. He was one of the guys that recognizes him in the paper.
Yeah, he turns in the main character to the police.
Yeah. So, you know, for the listeners who are probably not familiar with what the New Wave was, and they're probably maybe like, well, what is this? So tell us, maybe just give us a brief overview of what the French New Wave was all about.
Well, like a lot of European film companies after the Second World War, people wanted to make films, but they didn't want to use the Hollywood model. For one thing, they didn't have the money for all those sets and expensive actors and everything. So that was part of it. But the other part of it was wanting to do something different and artistic than had been achieved in Hollywood. And Hollywood's famous for seamless editing, a kind of continuity that lulls you into a sense of thinking you're actually in the film, that everything sort of falls away and you're just watching the movie. And what they wanted to do was play with that idea that instead of hiding all the cuts, make them really obvious and make it really obvious to the person watching the movie that this is a movie, this isn't real life, this isn't something you're going to forget everything around you and fall into the mm-hmm. movie. Instead, you're going to notice all the things that they are doing because they could.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first time I watched it, sometimes the jump cuts go a little bit like, what? Why is it cutting there?
He actually had 2.5 hours worth of edited material, and he had to cut it down to 90 minutes. So he literally just went through and just chopped out things he thought looked boring. Mm-hmm. So it is very jarring. All those cuts are very jarring. Mm-hmm. But they're accidental.
Yeah. And it was interesting looking up that this was his very first film. And it was, you know, looking at his career, he was already a pretty well-known guy, not as a director, but, you know, as a critic for, I hope I'm pronouncing this right,
Cahiers du Cinéma.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that he was involved with because his methods for filmmaking are more of an extension of his criticism. He's more interested in redefining film structure and style than actually being understood by the public.
Yeah, and it also, for the magazine, wasn't Truffaut also a critic?
Truffaut was as well, and so were some of the other New Age greats like Jacques Rivette and Claude Chabrol. Mm-hmm. In fact, Jacques Rivette plays a role in the movie too. He plays a dead body in the road. And of course, Melville plays the author.
Yeah, that was a funny scene. And it was interesting. We also, some people even consider this a Truffaut film because he was the writer and he created the story. And I was reading it. It was actually loosely based on a true story that there was this guy who killed a motorcycle cop. And
yes.
His name was also the same name of the character.
Michel. And he had a girlfriend who was a journalist.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of those ripped from the headlines kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. But Godard said famously, all you need to make a movie is a girl and a gun.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, a girl and a gun, that kind of leads into my next question. I felt this film was somewhat of a parody of film noir and the early gangster films. But not only because you obviously see Belmondo looking at the poster of Humphrey Bogart and he kind of models himself after him. But even the way it kind of at the end where it mocks the overtop death of the gangsters where he gets shot and he just runs for a whole block before he finally decides to go down and die.
Yeah, he does play with these film noir concepts, including the femme fatale, who's mm-hmm. blonde. But he kind of takes it to a different place because he's more playful with it, and he uses a lot of cultural references. There's Gene Seberg, who plays Patricia, who was in a movie before that called Bonjour Tristesse. And Godard said he thought the character Patricia was what happened to that character later in life. So he got that in there. And of course, the Maltese Falcon, Michel paraphrases a line of dialogue from the film about always fall in love with the wrong woman. And there's a reference to Dashiell Hammett's The Glass Key, where a character criticizes Michel for wearing silk socks with a tweed jacket. So there's lots of, there's even a reference to Bob Le Flambeur where he says, you know, well, Bob would have given me the money.
Yeah, and it was like, what happened to your friend Bob? It's like, oh, he's doing 10 years in the pen, the idiot. Yeah. And it was interesting. You're talking about how this kind of goes against Hollywood conventions, but, you know, it was interesting when you look up, you know, Godard and some of the films he considers his favorites, he was always a big fan of people like John Ford. Like, I think he said The Searchers is one of his most favorite films. And, you know, obviously with the Bogart references, he was a big fan of early gangster films and noir.
Well, you know, don't take the idea that they wanted to do something different from Hollywood as a rejection of Hollywood, because there were certain directors they liked very much, like Alfred Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. They thought he was kind of a new wave guy, but obviously he wasn't. He wasn't part of that movement, but he did innovative things as well. Mm-hmm. And I think Truffaut and Godard were originally slated to direct Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which was very much influenced by the French New Wave.
Yeah, and I think going a little bit off topic, but I know when Scorsese was doing Goodfellas, he actually said that film was like a French New Wave look at a gangster movie.
Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at that.
Because of all the freeze frames and everything and the narration.
And the asides, the voiceover, taking the asides to the kind of a different way of doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to earlier, I'm a big fan of Jean-Pierre Melville. I always liked his presence in the film. And actually, I was looking at, he was one of the people that suggested Godard's idea of jump cutting. He's like, why don't you just cut to the interesting stuff in the movie, you know, cut to the best shots, he said.
Well, he did some really interesting things with some of those jump cuts. There's a scene where Patricia is talking to her editor, and it's a great scene people talk about because you can see through these glass windows all of, you know, Paris unfolded at her feet. And in one sentence that the man is speaking, there's five cuts. And each time they come back, you see something's different, like the background's different or something's just not quite the same as the last shot. And it's very jarring and it happens very, very quickly. It gives you an overall effect rather than making you notice, oh, that jumped. It was just more of a unsettling.
Yeah. And the thing about the jump cuts is that, you know, they get, you know, whenever he takes the car ride, it always seems really quick. You're just like, he's in the car, jump, cut, jump, cut, jump, cut. Oh, and then now they're at parking.
I found an interesting quote about why cuts work from Walter Murch, who's an Academy-winning editor of Apocalypse Now and a bunch of other movies. He said, "We accept the cut because it resembles the way images are juxtaposed in our dreams. In fact, the abruptness of the cut may be one of the key determinants in actually producing the similarity between films and dreams." I think that's an interesting idea. That is kind of how it happens in a dream. Something's happening, and then all of a sudden, it's done, and it cuts to something else very abruptly, and you just take it for granted.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't stop and say, "Well, wait a minute, where was the fade out? Where was the iris out?"
Just cut, cut, cut,
cut, cut, cut.
And it was interesting. You know, going back to the talk a little bit about Jean-Pierre Melville, you know, wasn't he like considered? I mean, you know, it's Godard we're talking about, but wasn't Melville kind of considered the father of the French New Wave, the first guy to kind of bring up these ideas?
Well, I think you could make an argument that it was Godard, not Melville, but there's probably an argument to be made that Melville was more cutting edge. I think Godard's a little more well known because of this movie.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, other thing I liked about this movie was the lead role of Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Belmondo.
I always get those names wrong. But, you know, and he was kind of considered, you know, he did a couple other films with Godard, and he was like considered the leading man of the French New Wave, wasn't he?
Well, this movie really put him on the map and sort of established him, kind of like Bogart. Mm-hmm. When they finally decided to cast Bogart as a leading man, you know, they built him up that way. Before that, he just played gangsters.
Yeah.
He was not considered a leading man or a handsome man, but as soon as they packaged him differently, suddenly he was perceived differently.
Yeah.
So Belmondo lucked out by having this role because I think it gave him a kind of a bad boy persona that he worked for the rest of his career.
Yeah, and he has that face that kind of looks like it.
He was
looks
a boxer.
Like,
he looks like he's been hit in the face a few times.
Looks like
a tough guy.
And and then you talk a little bit about Jean Seberg. I know she was an American actress, and you said she did a movie.
Bonjour Tristesse.
Yeah, that was Otto Preminger, wasn't it?
Yes. And there's another reference to Otto Preminger. There's lots of, you know, allusions throughout the film. And that movie did not do really well, but some people were impressed with her performance in it, which is why she was picked for Breathless. And she went on to make another film with Godard But she had a tragic life. She took her life at age 40.
Yeah, I read about that.
She left a message for her son saying she just couldn't take, her nerves couldn't take it anymore. So she took barbiturates and killed herself in her car.
Oof.
A really, you know, strange end for somebody who was so young and had so much fame and recognition. Sad.
Yeah, that is terrible. And, you know, I guess we could go back to the, you know, he's a jump cuts, like, so it wasn't intended. That was what was interesting about me, is that, you know, you think like, wow, how did he think of that? It was like, oh, I didn't really think of it. It was just, you know, sort of incidental.
It always makes me think of that when I see a movie that I think is too long. You know, any movie that's over 2 hours, you think, you know, really, what could you have cut? So I understand how they would try to take things out. But, you know, other editors who aren't trying to do something aesthetically pleasing or just trying to do something, let's just make it shorter, have tried just randomly taking out frames, and you can totally see it, and it's really hard to look at. For some reason, it worked in this movie. Everything worked in this movie. He made it for practically nothing. Didn't even bother to get permits. He just shot wherever he felt like shooting. He actually had the cinematographer in a mailbox with a lens through a hole and boxes on his head. It was so everyday life going on that during the scene where Michelle is killed in the end, there was a policeman on a bus who hopped out to render aid.
Yeah, because I could see a lot during the street scenes whenever the two characters are talking, and you could see like onlookers like looking at the camera, like,
right?
What
like,
the heck is going
what's
on?
What's going on here? Wait, we're walking down the Champs-Élysées, and what's happening here?
I was surprised that, you know, did he get in trouble by the police saying, hey, do you have a permit to film here?
I think you would today. I think back then it was still so new, and he was still so, things were just so innovative. People just looked the other way. The French are, they love art, so
anything
for art.
And, you know, what was another interesting thing is we talk about how the cuts and how a lot of scenes are cut really short, but then there's that long scene in the apartment, which I timed. It goes on for like 24, 25 minutes. It takes up a third of the film, and it's just like they're in that apartment for all that time.
You know, he insisted on using that apartment. Mm-hmm. He had stayed in it, I think, when he came back from South America or something. And it's a real hotel. It's not a set. You know, he used real places.
Yeah, no studios at all, I think.
And that is a very odd scene because it does stretch on with a lot of seemingly unimportant things. You know, all that cutting going on to speed things up, and then there's this long extended scene where you sort of see them together and realize how far apart they are. They don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really understand each other at all.
Mm-mm. And, you know, and it also seems like they're really just so self-involved with each other, you know, that they're somewhat oblivious to what else is going on around them. Like, the big thing is that President Eisenhower was visiting Paris, but, you know, they kind of just sort of ignore that.
Right.
And the fact is, you know, you killed a cop, and here you are just hanging around this apartment for all this time.
Yeah. Well, you would have to hide out somewhere, but there isn't even that sense of anxiety.
No, he's not. He seems completely calm. It's like, you might want to be a little bit more anxious.
And smoking constantly.
Everybody's smoking in this film.
Yeah, I don't know if he ever puts the cigarette down, to be honest. I think he smokes the entire time. And huge cigarettes.
Yes.
Almost like cigars.
Yeah, it almost, you know, once again, it probably feels like it's mocking the 1930s, 40s gangster films where all of them were smoking. I mean, who made smoking look more cooler than Humphrey Bogart?
No wonder he was breathless.
I see what you did there.
Well, even actually at the end when he does do that final exhale, smoke comes out of his mouth.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Another thing I felt that was really breaking the rules in the film was there was quite a few moments where it's breaking the fourth wall. In the beginning, when he's on the road, he's riding, it's the part where he's about to kill the cop. You see him like looking at the camera and addressing the audience.
Right.
And then even at the end, Gene Seberg, after, you know, at the very end of the film, she's looking right into the camera. There's a few moments where characters are looking directly into the camera.
Yeah, Gene Seberg ends it by looking at the camera, and then she models that same tick that he had where she rubs her thumb across her lip like he did imitating Bogey. So it's almost like she takes over that role, but she's also looking at you, the viewer, as if to say, I don't know what you're saying, but some statement. What now?
Yeah, what now? You know, and like you said, it felt like this was a really, you talked about this earlier, but it's a really guerrilla style of shooting. And like you said, it's just like, I'm surprised that they still got, they let this film get made with all, the, you know. I even heard that one of the, for tracking the shot, they just had Godard in a wheelchair just moving.
Right. That's the shot where Michelle is being chased by the police. And they, you know, they talk to some people. And what Godard did was put the camera on his shoulder and film it. And then when he wanted to do the dolly shot, he sat in a wheelchair and somebody pulled him backwards so he could do the dolly shot. I mean, that's talk about, you know, shoestring budget.
Yeah.
No wonder he made it for so cheap.
And it reminds me somewhat of another film he did. It was called Alphaville. And it's supposed to be like this dystopian sci-fi world. And at the end, it's like I haven't seen it in a while, but like he saves a girl or something on the road in the sci-fi film. But in the background, you can see like traffic proceeding as usual as nothing's going on. And it's just like, is that intended? Is that in this dystopian sci-fi world?
He liked doing things with the camera that were about how to tell a story without really telling a story. It was all more about the art of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like he didn't care if it didn't make sense. He was just trying things.
He's just trying to mess with the audience.
Exactly.
You know, another thing I really liked was the jazz score.
I think that's what makes the movie, actually. Mm-hmm. It gives it that sense of that film noir and that kind of coolness. It's very hip.
Yeah, and it also, like, you know, like a jazz is a lot of improv. Like the whole film feels improv, and I think the score really helps it because you don't know really where the next scene's going. You don't know where anything is going with this film.
It also gives it a lighthearted feel, which feels out of place and yet kind of correct because you're watching the story of the gangster from the gangster's point of view.
Mm-hmm. And I think you also feel that the character is, you know, he's very, you know, she calls him a child. He's very immature. You know, he doesn't take this issue very seriously. And, you know, even though he killed a cop, like a lot of people would be like, oh, my God, like I need to go on the road. But he's just kind of, I'll just, you know, hang around with my girlfriend and do all these goofy things and, you know, flip up girls' skirts and stuff.
Even the scene where he kills the cop is sort of treated like an inevitability.
Mm-hmm.
And like, well, that's over with.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they cut to him running through a field. If you aren't watching, you'd miss the fact that he killed the cop in the first place.
Yeah, and, you know, even at the end, you know, he still has, you know, on his dying breath, he still kind of has enough time to make one last wisecrack to his girlfriend.
Which has been interpreted a couple of ways, none of which really makes sense.
Yeah, the one, so it was interesting. I watched this movie a while ago, and that version, it's like, you're a real creep or something. And then the other one I watched last night, it's like, you're a scumbag.
Right.
Or you make me want to puke. And there's like five different interpretations.
Which are all very different. And then her response is always, well, what's a scumbag? Or what does puke mean? Very peculiar, too, that she doesn't understand his dying words.
Mm-hmm.
You would think she would be the only one who would.
Yeah, well, also it's like misinterpreted because, you know, he's like, the one I said, he's like, I'm a real creep. And then she says, what did he say? And the cops say, he says, you're a real creep.
Yeah,
you're a real creep. And so, you know, the reception of the film, was this like the first film that not only was big in France, but it was also the one that really carried over into America where like American film critics really took notice of it?
Well, it was so different and no one had seen anything like it that it did make a big splash, but it especially made a big splash in France. It made a lot of money, especially considering he didn't pay a lot to make it in the first place.
You definitely get that budget to profit ratio up. And so this also was this the film that really kick-started the new wave where a lot of like later directors influenced like by this film, such as like Louis Malle or even Truffaut?
Or even Bonnie and Clyde movie.
With Arthur
Penn.
You
know, just the whole idea of making something that violent and shooting it the way they did. And the way they do those cuts. You know, you'll see Warren Beatty with playing with the toothpick in his mouth, and then it cuts to the gun that he's holding, and then it cuts to Bonnie, who's like giving him the side eye, looking at the gun, like her look at the gun, then back to the gun, back to the toothpick, back to the gun. It's very it adds a lot of tension, and this was a new way to do that.
Yeah. So would you say that go ahead.
It's hard for me to say that. I think yes, I'm sure that it influenced the new wave, but I can't help but think so because it was the first one I ever watched. Yeah.
And I also think, you know, it also probably also helped usher in the new Hollywood era where we would see just 5-6 years later. And I think, like you said, Bonnie and Clyde was one of the first films that kicked off that era.
And Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Easy Rider, which had that technique where they cut away to show like a flash forward. And then they decided they would do that three times in a row. And that would be the technique to indicate the flash forward. That was something that hadn't been done until the French did it. And then they brought it to Hollywood. So now we do it.
And so what was Godard's career during the New Wave? Not with this film, because I remember Alphaville, that was a big hit. And it was had its very, even it's a sci-fi film, it's a very low budget feel.
Right, and Band of Outsiders. Band of Outsiders. And Masculine, Feminine, and My Life to Live. Yeah, he made a lot of very thinky, philosophical, talky movies.
And I also think he was also very politically active. I mean, you don't, like we talked earlier, we don't really see it in this film. I mean, if there is, it's not extremely noticeable. But the one film, I'll probably mispronounce this one again, but it's Pierrot Le Fou.
Le Fou? Pierrot Le Fou.
Yeah, and there's a lot of like commentaries on like, you know, the Vietnam War and what was going on in Paris at the time with the 68 riots.
Well, I guess you could make a case for there being something slightly political in the fact that Eisenhower was visiting, and you know, who cares, because it's time to smoke and and lays around in a Paris hotel room.
It's like, oh, we don't have time for politics. Let's just hang around and smoke.
Actually, that sounds kind of like a French attitude in general. It's not a bad one.
Now, there's this, this makes me think of this Family Guy episode where they're in France. And this, you know, he goes, note to you French, just because the guy is, you know, in black and white smoking a cigarette does not make a good film.
That seems to be where they started with a lot of plots, though. Man with cigarette, fade in.
And so, you know, it was interesting looking up about Godard. I was completely surprised to find out the fact that he was still alive.
You know, me too. He's, what, 85 or something?
And,
yeah.
You know, what was his career like after the New Wave? Because all the stuff I'm familiar with was in the 60s during that New Wave era. But, like, what has he done, like, the last 30, 40 years? Like, I have not seen anything recently from him.
He hasn't. Although they've been talking about, there was some talk about a film he was supposed to be involved with in 2015. But I don't know if that came to pass. I think he just has settled back to be the grandfather of the New Wave.
Just kind of this guy hangs out, revels in his fame and his, okay.
I mean, it's hard to continually be innovative your entire life, especially when you come up with something that new. Then everything you do, it's either derivative or, you know, your new cool thing isn't as great as your last cool thing.
Yeah. And you think you kind of see that with a lot of directors, like even the film school generation in Hollywood with your Scorsese's and Spielberg's, that, you know, their films now, I don't really see them as, you know, brilliant, as innovative as they were like in the 70s and 80s.
That is a topic for a whole other show.
So looking at other directors from the French New Wave, like you said, we talk about Band of Outsiders. I'd also say the film that was actually before Breathless was 400 Blows. And I think those were also films that were also like, if you want to really study this movement, these are the films you got to watch.
Yes. And the 400 Blows was actually one of the reasons that he was able to make Breathless, because it was so well received. The 400 Blows is so autobiographical, though. It's so much about Truffaut's real life that it has more of a sense of a mockumentary, like a retelling of events, you know, through a filter that you can control. And that makes it less of a, it's more personal, where I think Godard's movie was a little more successful because it was a genre that people kind of already knew, which is the gangster film, which is, I mean, in a way, the two characters are kind of like Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, and, you know, like you say with Truffaut, yeah, films always feel a bit more intimate and personal. Like, even the other film, which was a little bit after the New Wave, which was Day for Night, that whole film is just about a film crew and their struggles and everything going through the film. You feel that's very kind of about the stuff he's had to deal with.
Right, yeah. All of his movies seem to have an autobiographical flair to them, where Godard just seemed to be playing, just having a good time with film and seeing what he could get away with.
Mm-hmm. And so for anybody who's listening, I understand you are teaching a French film course. So I'm sure you're going to be talking about all these films, right?
I am going to be talking about all of these films. I'm teaching French film for the first time in fall of 2016. It's Tuesdays from 9 to noon, which is kind of early. But it will be an opportunity to watch films by French directors and discuss them. So I'm looking forward to it very much.
So I imagine the period you will cover would even be before the New Wave, so just people like Renoir.
Well, yes, I am going to talk about Renoir, and of course I'll talk about Méliès, who, by the way, invented the jump cut.
Oh, really?
He actually invented the jump cut, but he was using it for a magic trick. He wasn't using it for a stylistic telling of a story. He was using it as a technique to show his magic tricks in his movies, but he's actually the one who came up with it. So we'll talk a little bit about Méliès, but we'll also talk about some contemporary directors and what's going on in French film today.
Oh, and also another one was Alice Guy Blaché, because I remember I talked about her. That's right. Admiral Householder.
Yes, one of the very first directors and a woman.
All right, sounds awesome. So be sure to sign up, everybody.
Yes, everybody, sign up.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about French director Jean-Luc Godard and his new wave classic Breathless. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. or Sunday at 2:30 p.m. or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
It was great having you. For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, "He said you make him want to puke."